definitely acknowledge Joe as being the instigator here for assembling to talk about wireworms. He definitely was talking to a lot of people and getting us to come out and do it. So thank you, Joe, for those efforts. I guess I wanted to start my talk with I wondered how I got here, co-moderating, co-organizing a session on soil insects and wireworms. What in the heck got you here? And I remember the day exactly. I was hired at Virginia Tech, my very first Virginia Irish Potato Board grant, my very first grant that I wrote, and I was proud of that thing. It was loaded with all these neat Colorado potato beetle studies, and I walked out of there doing wireworm work. I was like, yes, you can have your funding, but it wasn't to do those potato beetle studies, and ended up having to work on them. So that was 8 years ago, seven or eight years ago, and so we basically had to start from scratch. Like, I don't know a heck of a lot about them, and basically what I'm going to do is talk to you about the last 6 or 7 years of just what I've been learning out there. There's no way I'm an expert, but certainly appreciate some of the things that I've learned today, for sure. These are the kind of things that our growers were facing, and we saw this. We would go to their farms, and at times they would get damaged this bad. I mean, these were the potato tubers being dug out, and the funny thing is, sometimes they could market those tubers. Depending on the year, they would be acceptable. But a year when there's plenty of potatoes, they're not going to take them. So I'm not saying that the whole batch looked like this, but so the growers, that, you know, they definitely considered it a concern and something needing to work on. But you'd also see them in that seed piece a lot, and I wasn't really sure what kind of damage was really going on. We didn't see stand differences all that much, but they would be there in that seed piece early in the season. Speaking of our season, here's basically a little bit different from some of the things we've seen in the Pacific Northwest, and even in Jersey with the potato crop. We're getting going early. Growers are out there in February planting potatoes, and if not February, then hopefully March. If you're getting into April, you're getting a little late for planting. And so basically, we've got a season where the potatoes are pretty much in the ground, and things are going on, and the plant's really growing, rapid tuber development, and then by July they're pretty much all dug. So that's our season. So it's relatively short, basically the spring. You're getting into the summer, we're pretty much finished. So we basically had to take that system and try to find ways of managing wireworms. One of the things I'd looked at early was basically what kind of cropping systems seemed to promote these wireworms, what species we had out there, and the study started out looking at different systems, a no-till corn, soybean, wheat, potatoes, fallow fields, and these were all ones that could potentially or did end up going back into potatoes the following season. And I'll say I'm not going to talk much about the differences between these because we found none. If I put a bar graph up there and looked at wireworm densities following these different things, we didn't find a difference. It didn't matter what the cropping system was. Now, I know there's been some work at NC State that seems that there is some cropping systems, at least in the sweet potato systems, where depending on the previous crop, it'll impact wireworms. But I'll show you that's probably a different wireworm species, the Conodaris, more in that aspect. But we found no effect of previous crop in the Virginia potatoes. What we did with sampling was basically took a golf hole cutter, went out and put a corn wheat seed bait down in the hole, and then because it, depending on the soil climate, we put some black plastic there to warm the soil to draw them in, and basically came back and a week to 2 weeks later and found what wireworms were in the fields. And I'll also mention we did this in the fall. My plans were to do it in the fall, winter, spring. Well, we didn't find them in the fall. We went out there and we just could not find the wireworms with this baiting technique. They were in fields that growers thought they had them the previous year. I mean, occasionally one or two, but we just were not finding them. It was strange. We were going out in October, November. Now, if you came back in the spring, you would find wireworms there. So they were definitely going down deep. But fall sampling, and you probably know Joanne Whalen from Delaware. She told me, Tom, don't even worry about that. They've already done it. It was one of those that I had already done it for that fall. And basically, we gave up on the fall sampling, which really hurt our potential in Virginia because, again, growers are going to be planting in maybe February and March, so if you're going to do any sampling, you pretty much better have done it in the fall because you're not going to be getting out there before they plant. But there was information that we gleaned anyway. We found basically with the spring samplings that about a quarter of the fields that we sampled were over threshold, given a threshold of about one wireworm coming to that bait. And that's a pretty high risk of potential damage. And we had a good handle of our species. As Joe mentioned, the Melanus communis, same one that we had in pretty much 75% to 80% of the fields. That was the main species out there. And I will say that I think that probably runs the whole mid-Atlantic, at least up the Jersey, down to Virginia. But I think things change in the state of Virginia. I think if you start to get near the North Carolina line, and we got Ken Sorensen and Mark Abney here, and they could probably talk more on that. But so we're looking at the mid-Atlantic U.S. as probably represents. And then we got this Conodaris lividus out there as well. So there's a look at our species that we're finding, but so primarily that one species that we've already heard about, the corn wireworm. This was something that we noticed, and these are across five fields, two different years, and this is the percentage of the tubers that were damaged by wireworms, that had wireworm holes, and digging tubers from the middle of May up into the middle of July, and in all the cases, as you see the graphs, they basically, the later you get, the longer the tubers are in there, the more wireworm damage you got. We've seen that before. We were seeing it in the previous talks, that same trend. Juan Alvarez in Idaho, different wireworms, but the same trend. Jerry Gadu up in New Jersey, completely different time of the season. We were dealing with spring with mine, he's dealing with the summer and the fall. But look at that, the same trend. Longer the tubers are out there, the more of them that are damaged by wireworms. So basically that's the statement that we concluded. I'll also mention that similar things have been found in Florida with and Melanus communis is down there. Completely different time of the year, but the longer the tubers are in there. So that's not by chance. There's a reason and something's going on. One, I wondered, well, you know, are you just getting higher densities? I remember there was a question posed to Juan Alvarez, when are the eggs laid? And I guess your question is, are you getting more damage because eggs have been laid and maybe there was a big flush of larvae coming out there? That doesn't look to be the case. In all of my fields, the wireworm densities were actually dropping off. More than likely they were going deep in the soil as it was getting hotter, but we weren't finding as many wireworms, but we're finding more damage the later they're out there. So if you look at the biology, the published biology, this is from a 1975 paper by Fisher and Keister and those in Missouri, and there's basically your these are the numbers of wireworms that come to the surface of the soil, and basically you're looking at a springtime. That's when they peak, they drop down deep during the hot months, and then here they showed a little blip. We didn't have that blip. We couldn't find these things in the fall. So this is coming out of Florida, published in the Advances in Potato Pest Management book. Same thing, a trend in the spring, and in the summer they appear to drop off. So what we found was consistent with what's in the literature. So what's going on here? Why are we getting more damage the later you get in? My guess is the hotter and drier, from at least in the Virginia system, soil's getting hotter and drier as you're getting into the summer, and I truly believe that wireworms are seeking out moisture sometimes almost as much as food. Sometimes our soils can get incredibly dry. If you're digging potatoes in July, there isn't much that's moist in that soil a lot of times except a potato tuber. I mean, it's a big fat ball of moisture, and it's no wonder that the wireworms are going in there. Our growers have commented that in drought years they seem to have a little bit more wireworm damage than normal, and that would lend itself to that as well. Also, as you're getting later in the season, there's just greater mass of tubers that are down in that soil, so there's a better chance of a wireworm encountering a tuber. And then also your damage is cumulative. If you're digging tubers from a period, one damaged, in my case, in May, is probably still going to be a damaged tuber come July, so we're going to count that one plus the ones damaged in June and July. So it's cumulative. I think it's just a matter of all this going on. And the bottom line is, the longer you leave your tubers out there, the greater chances of wireworm. So that's at least one take-home message for potato growers everywhere, I think. Just a true account there. Okay, the control situation, of course all growers are interested in this. This is what they want to see you working on. We've already talked about some of these insecticides with Bob and Juan in particular. A lot of our growers were using Thimet 20G, a granule. MoCap was another very popular one, Ethoprop. When I got there, these were the insecticides used for wireworm control, both organophosphates. Both the EPAs had issues with the FQPA. Diazinon got canceled when I first started the job. Dicystine, basically, no one was using. So that was my situation when we came in. I basically hit the literature and was studying wireworm trials, and Juan had talked about this paper came out in Pesticide Outlook. It just basically summarized trials, insecticide trials, whether we could, these are different species in different parts of the U.S., and just what was there a general pattern, and these are pre-plant versus in-furrow versus post-plant drench at where a grower, potato grower, might side dress. And, you know, not often a difference in the application technique, but you know, basically MoCap and Thimet, the growers had figured it out, were probably the best things out there. So we were looking at the potential that maybe these insecticides may not be around forever. Started doing wireworm insecticide trials, and we're still doing them to date. Started these in 2001. Basically all the trials, we followed a very similar pattern. They're two-row 20-foot plots, either Superior or Atlantic potatoes. And almost always the insecticides were put down in furrow after the seed piece was dropped. Otherwise we will note the difference. So all the trials basically followed this pattern. Some of the things we've looked at, the neonicotinoids, basically all the ones that have come out, imidacloprid, thimethoxam, dinotefuran, clothianidin, all of which have labels now, these insecticides. And then, of course, region and capture, they've already been brought up. And rather than going through the details, here's just a summary of seven trials that included all of these treatments. We've got some combos in there. We looked at the neonics with regent. We looked at the neonics with capture, but bifenthrin or pyrethroid, all of the ones by themselves, and then the standard was either thimin or MoCap as a in-furrow application. And in general, if you summarize across all of them, you were getting about 60-70% control. So it looked like we had some alternatives to OPs out there when you take it as a broad look at it. And this research has just recently come out. Juan Alvarez, you heard him speak earlier from Idaho. He's done the same exact trials in Idaho on different wireworms. So he's going to be publishing the work as well. And actually got a little bit different with the performance of the neonicotinoids. And if we have time, I'd like to throw that out there, whether anyone might know why neonicotinoids such as imidacloprid seem to work better against melanotis in Virginia than it did on his limonius in Idaho. But striking difference in the performance. This work, what came out of it? Well, we learned a little things, but then I think we contributed a lot of data to getting these insecticides labeled that our potato growers now have. In 2007, they got capture, the capture LFR that can be put down mixed with the fertilizers. And then the regent label also came the same year in 07. And that's a in-furrow one-time shot at 3.2 ounces. So some other things we've been dabbling with is biological control of wireworms. We actually have had some extension agents and organic growers ask me to do this kind of work, and so we've dabbled in a little bit. Some of the things we've looked at, nematodes and entomopathogenic fungi. Some of the nematode work, we had Dr. Ed Lewis was in our department at Virginia Tech. He's at UC Davis now, but we collaborated with him, and he seems to have a good idea of picking the right nematode for the right situation, and he came up with this Heterodidus megidus, manufactured in England, and he thought that would be a very good candidate for going after this difficult beast. And we actually did some trials. This was a container trial where we put some sandy loam soil in some shoebox-sized containers, and first put the wireworm larvae in there and let them get established, let them get hungry, and then we either mixed 500 mils of water in the container as a control, or a 500 mil solution of 76,000 infected juveniles of the H. megidus. And basically, we just wanted to see after 2 weeks what happened. And we also put potato tubers in there as well, five small potato tubers. And we had a reduction in the damage. It wasn't significant, but a trend there. It basically cut damage in half in that 2 week span. And then we also had mortality was difficult to judge, but higher more dead wireworms in the containers that we put the nematodes in. So there's something there, but when you got into the literature, you basically even the nematode specialists feel that there's not a good chance of getting wireworms. They have just found ways to avoid being killed by these things. Well, that's their whole life cycle is living in the soil, so they found ways to prevent nematodes from taking them out, and just didn't seem very promising. We did do a trial in a field and got, this is percentage of damaged tubers, we got significant differences compared to the untreated control. Here's thymet here. This looked very encouraging. Getting real excited. Looked like a whole student project here looking on this nematode species against wireworms. And then, well, we had to continue doing trials. And here's releasing H. megatus, and we got about 35% of the tubers damaged. Here's your control. So we're actually getting more damage now. Tried it again. It just didn't seem to work in the field. The moisture was there. We just Ed left, and I gave up on it. So anyway, that's for that. Someone else wants to pick it up. It's still out there. Moving into another biopesticide, the Metarhizium anisoplia. We're going to hear from Jared Leland in a little bit. I happen to have a friend working in a company that manufactured one of these, but from Novozymes Biologicals, and it's called MET52G, a granular of this Metarhizium. And basically, I'm just going to show you four trials that I think were far more encouraged by some of the results here than with the nematodes. Although we didn't get a significant difference, again, this is percentage wireworms damaged. The treatments that we looked at were the fungi alone, MoCap as a standard, platinum neonicotinoid thymethoxam, and then some combos of the MET52 with these things, and then a control. That's going to be the same across all these trials, as will the rates. So we had a numeric difference, wasn't statistically significant, but there's something there. It's worth looking at again. In another trial, had a lot more damage, 45% damaged tubers in the control, and we're getting definitely a reduction, something numerical. Again, statistically, we're having issues. That's the frustration with wireworm trials, and in particular, just often don't get a statistical difference because of variability. And you saw Joe's picture of what Joe, when it was Juan, showed you just the variability in the pressure in the field with densities. Difficult beast to do a trial with. Here's some trials from this year, however. We're getting, this wasn't as great, some variability out there, but actually the MET52G, wasn't looking too bad. Again, in none of these trials, if you looked at them, I mean, these were all replicated, did we get significant differences? But in all of them, we got numeric differences. So since all the trials were done pretty much the same way, we pulled them across these four trials, and that's where we're getting something that's pretty interesting and at least exciting to us for the future. And here's your entomopathogenic fungi alone, and here's your organophosphate standard. So we, as a whole, across the four trials, it's looking pretty encouraging to go down this path as a potential here for organic control of wireworms and potatoes. And I'm not going to steal any thunder from someone else who's going to be talking about this, but that's definitely an area of research I think we're going to continue with. And that's all I have. Any, I guess, time for a question or two more? Yes, Paul.
When you were doing the nematode assay, did you compare or separate H class and grain starts of the larvae?
The question was, when I was doing the nematode assays, did I separate age classes of the wireworm larvae?
Yeah, and look at their...
No. We tended to get the biggest ones that we could, the largest larvae, but as you probably know, there aren't commercial wireworm colonies out there, so in order to do any bioassays, you need to get the bugs yourselves. So you've got, you and a few friends out there with shovels, and it's like, how many do we need here to do this assay? By the time you get 100 or 500, you're going to use those 500. You're not. I think if I had to tell the guys, no, I want 500 ones that are an inch long, I think I wouldn't have had a work crew. But yeah, Frank.
You said that you're sampling the fall density to help your growers in the planting back in February and March. What about right after harvest, July, August?
Okay, the question is timing of sampling. that in the fall didn't seem to help growers planting in February, but what if we had sampled right after harvest the previous season? And an issue there, they don't typically follow potatoes from a previous potato field. So you would be sampling another crop, you know, something that's planted likely to corn or a soybean small grain situation. It's seldom potatoes right after potatoes. So
how about whatever field's going to be in potatoes next year, sample that?
Sample that in. Well, it's potential. I think there's still some. I think in general, a field that has had a history of damage will continue to be a wireworm situation. So we kind of use that as a general guide. It's seems to be a cop out right now, but it's the best we can go with. It just seems like if it's historically had some wireworm problems, there's potential there. So okay, thank you.
Yeah.